Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Russian President Vladimir Putin enjoys sky-high approval ratings. In October, 84%. And in yesterday's parliamentary elections, Putin's United Russia Party took well more than 60% of the vote. Critics charge that Russians were strong-armed into supporting Putin. It's a victory Putin plans to use. Though he steps down as president in March, no one expects him to give up power. This hour, On Point, Putin's victory and Russia's future. And later this hour, we'll hear about yesterday's elections in Venezuela. But first, joining me now from Moscow is Arkady Ostrovsky, correspondent for The Economist magazine. Welcome, Arkady Ostrovsky.
Good morning.
So please tell us, run through what happened yesterday, what you saw, and what you think is going to happen next.
Well, what happened yesterday was an election which was effectively turned into a referendum for President Putin's popularity. He had the ticket for the United Russia Party, which is the Kremlin Party, without even joining it. And that was the main point, really, of this election. It was not so much about the composition, the exact composition of the Duma, or the lower house of parliament, which is little more than a rubber stamp body anyway. It was about Putin's popularity. His victory was the victory for United Russia, they proclaimed. What I saw yesterday was also a large number of violations. Even in Moscow, what I saw was...
Poll violations you're talking about.
Well, for example, what I saw yesterday was busloads of people who were ferried from one polling station to another. These were workers from different cities who at first refused to talk to me, then warmed up a bit. I started asking them what's going on. They said they've been on this bus for several hours since lunchtime, and this was the evening by then, and I saw them at one polling station, then the same bus went to another polling station, and this merry-go-round, as they call it here, voting, was going on apparently all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just one example, not to mention the fact that the propaganda, it's hard to think of another word, really, the propaganda for President Putin on central Russian television channels was absolutely extraordinary.
How much was there?
Including on the day when they're supposed to keep quiet.
Hmm. How much was there? You said it went right up until polling time, and we know that any opposition just about disappeared from the public space in terms of advertising or announcements. I mean, how much propaganda was on television yesterday?
Well, the central channels, the central television channels broadcast Mr. Putin, who is, as I said, the number one on the United Party, United Russia Party list. They broadcast his address to the nation, which he made a few days earlier. So they rebroadcast it. They cut out the bit saying, you must vote for United Russia, but they left, I count on your support. Now, it is absolutely obvious to anyone who watches it that what he's talking about is, you know, people's support for United Russia. So there was that going on. There were banners all over Moscow still advertising for President Putin. Some of the observers and journalists, including myself, been, you know, kept away from some of the polling stations not to get too close. So there was that. I mean, there was quite a lot of rigging, I think, going on, and that's indeed what the OSCE said this morning.
Arkady, can you tell us where this leaves the opposition and what other parties do have representation now in parliament?
Well, there are three other parties, apart from United Russia, that passed the very high 7% barrier for the seats in parliament. And these are the communists, which are very much weakened now. They've got 11%. And two other parties is the Nationalist Liberal Democratic Party and Just Russia, which is another Kremlin satellite. I mean, where basically what's happened here is, you know, in part a restoration of one-party monopoly on the whole political system, which is obviously quite dangerous. The other thing that happened here is we've seen, if not a stage rehearsal, then certainly setting of the stage for the March presidential elections, which are much more important.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about giving President Putin a mandate, a popular mandate, to retain power not as a president, perhaps, you know, as a national leader of some sorts, or perhaps a prime minister, but to retain influence nonetheless in the country after he stepped down as president in March 2008.
Did you?
And that's what it was very much about. It was a referendum on his popularity. And what, as one of the Russian political analysts wrote this morning, you know, Russian people will not be electing a new president. They'll be waiting for this president to tell them who to vote for.
I wanted to ask you about that, the reaction of the Russian people and what you've seen this morning. People seem satisfied from what you're telling us. Has there been any meaningful statement? Are they able to get it into the newspapers from the opposition?
Not very much. I mean, the opposition, the liberal opposition, is clearly extremely, I mean, disappointed is the wrong word, because, you know, it's not that they, you know, I mean, they have been reduced to 1% of the votes. They've been marginalized. They've been discredited through the media. It's really pretty, I mean, the next step they'll have to take is really to shape themselves up and in the underground. I don't know. I mean, this parties have been reduced to very, very little. And in terms of, you know, have they been able to protest? Well, on the remaining media outlets, you know, such as a radio station in Moscow and a few newspapers, yes, there have been quotes and there have been speeches from the liberal opposition saying this is a complete sham. This is the worst election we've ever had since the Soviet times. And I must say they've got a point there.
All right. Arkady Ostrovsky is Moscow bureau chief for The Economist magazine. And thank you very much for joining us today, Arkady. Thank you again. Joining us now from Washington is Dmitry Sidorov, Washington bureau chief for the Russian daily newspaper Kommersant. He's also a columnist for the online Russian journal Ezhdnevny Journal. Also with us from Moscow is Masha Lipman, political analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace's Moscow Center and editor-in-chief of the journal Pro et Contra. Thanks very much for being here, both of you.
How are you, Jackie?
Hello. Thank you.
I'm just fine. Let's talk about how Russia is. I mean, know that both of you have watched this intently. Why don't we start with you, Dmitry?
Okay. Well, honestly speaking, I think that it goes without saying that the election process over there in Russia was rigged. And honestly speaking, the whole procedure reminded me of elections during the Soviet time when, you know, when TV hosts cheerfully announced that, and I quote, as one, all the Soviet people went to election booth and voted for the members of the Communist Party. Look, if you analyze the data coming from, you know, different areas of Russia, for example, in Chechnya, which is altogether the troubled Russian region of northern Caucasus, more than 99% of the population participated in the elections. Outstanding, I should say. It reminds me again of the Soviet times when the percentage of people who came to the booth was close to this number. And out of this, more than 99% of the Chechen population, 99.27% voted for the pro-Putin United Russia. And more or less the same appeared to happen in the bordering to Republic of Ingushetia, where 98% of the population voted for United Russia. It's mind-boggling. And President Putin immediately jumped to comment on the results of the Duma or the parliament elections yesterday, saying the following, and I quote, "It's now clear to me that Russians will never allow their country to develop along the destructive path seen in some other countries of the former Soviet Union," end of quote. In my view, he was talking about Ukraine and Georgia, definitely, that are trying hard to overcome the remains of the Soviet past, despite an active Russian meddling in its affairs. So Arkady was right when he said that it was sort of a referendum, and it was kind of a process, a preparation process for the upcoming presidential elections. And the other thing I want to say, when I was just thinking about about the whole issue. I recall the line from Mel Brooks in The History of the World. He said, it's good to be a king. It's good to be a dictator, actually. I think that the system implemented by Putin and his cronies, is a refurbished Bolshevik one. The difference is that, although crooked, but still reforms initiated by Yeltsin somehow made it possible for the West to accept Russia into the world financial and political community. And the Kremlin under Putin made most out of it, working the international system hard for the benefit of a small group of people. Now, the question of support of the Russian population of Putin's policy, in my view, could be explained easy enough, because the high oil prices, on another hand, allowed the Kremlin not only to make more money for themselves, but to share nickels and dimes with the Russian electorate, aging population, and what's called in Russia the budgeteers, meaning those people who are paid salaries by the state, like teachers, doctors, and etc.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about United Russia's landslide victory yesterday and what it means for Vladimir Putin. My guests this hour are Masha Lipman, a political analyst in Moscow, and Dmitry Sidorov, Washington-based journalist. In May, Tom Ashbrook spoke with chess champion and Russian opposition leader Garry Kasparov. Tom asked Kasparov why he's involved in politics.
It's my country, and I believe my country is in trouble. I have been defending the cause of my country for 25 years, and I believe now I'm doing the same. I think the country is on the wrong path. For 7 years, Putin and his cronies have been steadily destroying democratic institutions in Russia, and we have to restore it as soon as possible. Otherwise, the country will be in jeopardy.
Masha Lipman, let's turn to you. Hello there in Moscow.
Hello.
You are a political analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace Moscow Center. You've written that Vladimir Putin seems very interested in preserving what you might call the conventions or technicalities of democracy, but mashing the contents thereof.
Yes, indeed. President Putin seems strangely attached to the letter of the law and of the Constitution, sometimes at the expense of the spirit. And this might explain why he chose to really step down when his second constitutional term expires in spring, instead of actually staying on for a third term, which actually a majority of the Russian people would be happy about, and which the Russian elites would want him to do, and actually which would make many of the Western investors happy too, because this would mean, or probably we should say by now, would have meant that Putin will be able to stay the course. However, he chose to step down, but at the same time, it is impossible for him to step down for real. Putin is in need of something that is not compatible, to step down and to stay on at the same time. Whereas the need to step down is explained by the
Let's hear from one of our callers. Jay is calling from
Hang up.
I think perhaps he's not any longer. Thomas is calling from Groton, Connecticut. And let's go to Tom. And Tom, you're on the line.
Thank you, Jackie. My question was regarding something that Arkady had said earlier on the show about the rigging of the elections. And I was just curious, had the rigging not occurred, what the actual voting rates would have been for United Russia in the election yesterday.
Dmitry Sidorov, is there any way to know that?
No. No, I think that, at the same time, it's hypothetical, definitely, but I think that in any case, United Russia would have won the elections. I mean, the only problem is what is the percentage it would have received as a result of it. Now, the whole thing is, the Kremlin right now does need to rig the elections in order to achieve the United Russia's win, but the fact of the matter is that they're still more than willing. They're very cautious. They're very nervous. And they want to be 100% assured that the United Russia will not only win the elections, but it will that it will overwhelmingly be ahead of any of its competitors.
Marsha Lipman, sorry we lost you there for a moment, and you're rejoining us now. We've been talking about the fact that, in Dmitry's opinion, the elections didn't need to be rigged because so many people were willing to vote for Vladimir Putin anyway. Why was there this tremendous push and demonization of the opposition, which I want to talk about in a moment, the rhetoric that was used? Why this sort of frantic feeling?
Yeah, very good question indeed. Why the urge to have a high turnout and a high showing for the United Russia if it was assured of a majority anyway? And actually, the United Russia has been by far the most popular party in Russia since its foundation during Putin's first term. I think the urge comes from this transformation of what technically remained a parliamentary election into a referendum, which only happened 2 months ago. And whereas in an election a majority is enough, and it doesn't matter very much how big this majority is. In fact, only a year ago, the Kremlin was not worried at all about the turnout, and it even canceled the requirement of a minimum turnout standard. So, but in a referendum, you cannot be happy with a lukewarm support. You want ardent support. You want overwhelming majority. You want really an expression of national overwhelming support and a desire of the public to give free hand to the president. Hence the urge to bring more people to the polls and to ensure that United Russia gains a landslide, not just a majority. Mm-hmm. In order to achieve both high turnout and high majority for the United Russia, the authorities high and low found themselves under pressure to bring in more people. And, of course, the way they saw to bring more people involved tricks. Reports are numerous coming from all over. I will cite just one when people were forced to take absentee ballots so that instead of voting next to their homes, they were forced to come to an assigned precinct where they would vote so that their bosses would see them.
Well, not just tricks, but also threats. You've both written about threats that have gone on in all of Russia's provinces, right?
Yeah, this happened all over, and these reports came from all over. And even though the Russian officials deny such allegations, however, the sheer number of such reports and the information you find about them in blogs, because many people from all over Russia are sharing their experience with this election, very unpleasant, sometimes ugly experience with this election, on in the blogosphere. So the sheer number of these complaints indicates that refutation by the officials are not very convincing.
Dmitry, you wrote about Vladimir Putin's popularity with an anecdote that I thought was so telling, and that was the soap factory anecdote. Could you repeat that? That you said he doesn't need to be popular in the sense that he, in a political sense, because in a practical sense, one of his reasons for popularity is he's made Russia work. That before, if you worked for a soap factory, you might have gotten paid with a box of soap. Now you get money.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, basically, what I said before is that the crumbs from or pennies from oil proceeds Russia is enjoying right now are going to pay salaries or increase salaries for those people in Russia who are paid by the government. And compared to, for example, struggling Yeltsin's times when in the beginning people were basically, their salaries were delayed or not paid at all, or as you mentioned, they receive, for example, if you work at the soap factory, you will be paid in soap, and then if you go to the market or somewhere or start calling your friends and relatives, asking them to buy the soap from you, you are soliciting them to do that and then get money for that. And definitely it requires some time because you cannot chew soap or you cannot make dinner out of soap. So, yes, definitely it's a huge difference. But on the other hand, look, I will give you an example of my grandmother, for example. She's 85 years old, and altogether her pension is, she lives in Moscow, and her pension altogether is, I think, not more than $120 or $130 a month. And if it was not for support of my parents and myself, she wouldn't be able to survive. So, again, well, it's a real issue.
That memory's live for a lot of Russia's aging population.
Absolutely, but on the other hand, they used to think, okay, Putin is a strong leader. Putin is increasing our benefits. Putin is trying to fight hard with the enemies of the country, such as the U.S., for example, and the West, that that are not allowing Russia to prosper. And well, we should be patient enough, and we should wait a little bit. And if Putin succeeds, and we want him to succeed, so that's what they think. Then we'll have a bright future. But in fact, the future is so bright that I should really wear shades. Because this policy of nationalism attached with this idea, well, Bolshevik implemented idea of countries surrounded by enemies, definitely makes Russia a very scary state.
Let me take one more call here. Jay is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Jay.
How are you?
Good. What's your question this morning?
Well, I have two points, one comment, perhaps. I'm a little disappointed because the Western, especially Western European media, seems to be taking this consolidation of power by Putin very lightly, and I think that's an underestimation. And I'd like to get your guest comments on the fact that, you know, this is exactly what goes on, this type of action preceding dramatic shifts in power, dramatic grabs of dictatorial power. This is what Mussolini did. This is what Hitler did. This is what Fidel Castro did. You know, everyone knows the economic turmoil in Russia. And Putin, with thanks to the help of the oil that your guest mentioned and the money, has been able to make people a little bit happy. And those people have gladly traded their security and their freedom for what I think is a potentially big change, big grab of power on the order of Mussolini and Castro. And okay. I wonder what your guest thinks.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk about that. You, early in the hour, talked about Mel Brooks, and it's good to be a king. Maybe it's good to be a czar. It's one thing to be a czar. It's another
good to be a dictator.
To demonize the opposition. What is going on here in terms of, we don't know what Vladimir Putin, what position he's going to want to take after March, whether he'll go for trying to be president again or premier. But in the conventions of dictatorship, Masha and Dmitry, what would you say you're seeing in terms of rhetoric and what is happening with perhaps the opposition and consolidation here that raise warning flags for you?
Well, actually, I think what your listener said is a large exaggeration. Putin is not a dictator. And what Putin has done in Russia is push it back on the paternalistic pattern, which means a big rift between the state and the society, the state being omnipotent and the society fragmented and very weak. However, if we look at Russia's history, which has been largely paternalistic throughout its course, this period...
And it sounds as if we have once again perhaps lost Masha Lipman in Moscow.
I'm not surprised.
I'm Jackie Leiden, and you're listening to On Point. I'd like to add one more voice to the conversation. Joining us now from Washington is David Kramer, Deputy Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs at the State Department, and he handles Russian affairs. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
So this is a predictable outcome, but one that the State Department has been watching. What's the official reaction?
We certainly have taken note of the preliminary results that the United Russia Party that President Putin headed has obtained a large majority of seats in the new Duma. But we also have noted the numerous allegations and reports of violations on Election Day. We've urged the Russian government to investigate those and take them seriously. We also took note of the concerns that popped up in the campaign leading up to the election, the use of state administrative resources in support of the United Russia Party, the bias of state-owned or influenced media in favor of United Russia, the intimidation of the political opposition, the lack of equal opportunity encountered by opposition candidates and parties, both in the registration and in the conduct of the campaigns. We also expressed sincere regret that the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's democratic operation, ODIHR as it's called, was not in a position to observe the elections because of restrictions that the Russian government imposed on it, including delays issuing visas. So all of these things, I think, are matters of concern, but we'll have to see what further results come about. We don't expect major changes, but certainly United Russia is emerging from this with a fairly strong hand.
Well, what about anything like a real declaration of concern? President Bush talked about perhaps investigating voter fraud, but that's pretty mild compared to some of the complaints that we've been hearing and some of the rhetoric, which has been very much aimed at Washington, has it not?
Sure. The rhetoric that we've been hearing from Moscow has indeed been directed, I think, principally
at
Washington.
Is this a new Cold War?
I'm sorry?
Is this a new Cold War?
I think it's U.S. government officials are always reluctant to go that far. In fact, I don't think it is a new Cold War. The Cold War was a different kind of situation. What we are seeing is certainly anti-Western, but particularly anti-American rhetoric on the rise in Russia. That is not a healthy development and not one that we welcome. But I think it is fair to say that we have been rather outspoken about developments internal in Russia. President Bush, in fact, himself released a statement last Monday following the arrests and the violent handling of demonstrations by opposition.
But a statement is a very easy thing for a nation as big as Russia, which seems to really be feeling its oats here, to dismiss.
Whether it dismisses it or not, statements by the United States, but not just by the United States, but by our European allies, I think are acknowledged in Russia. For example, the German government today came out with some strong criticism of the Duma elections. The others have as well, including the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's Parliamentary Assembly issued a fairly critical statement. Russia, I don't think, is immune to Western reaction and Western criticism. In fact, one might argue it's particularly hypersensitive to such criticism. But I think it is important that the United States, as well as our Western allies, speak out when we see there are problems in Russia or problems in Russian foreign policy. And that's something I think we have been doing rather consistently.
Okay, thank you very much. David Kramer is Deputy Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs at the State Department. He joined us today from Washington. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about yesterday's parliamentary election in Russia. In a moment, we'll turn to Caracas for the latest on yesterday's election in Venezuela. My guests this hour are Masha Lipman of the Carnegie Center in Moscow and Dmitry Sidorov, Washington bureau chief for the Russian newspaper Kommersant. Let's use our remaining time to talk about what this presages. In March, there will be a presidential election. We don't know where Vladimir Putin will stand. I'd like to ask both of you to speculate. And Masha, I'm sorry we keep losing you. I hope it's just an accident.
I do, too.
So what do you think will come about in Masha in March? Is Vladimir Putin going to feel so empowered that perhaps he does a third bid for the presidency?
Well, actually, I think more likely that Putin has already reached the peak of his power. And the most interesting thing begins now after the parliamentary election. The reason why Putin wanted to transform what is technically a parliamentary election into a referendum is in order to have what he said a moral right to hold to account both the legislative and the executive branch even beyond the end of his term. But how he's going to do it, he has not disclosed yet. Putin's very secretive and never makes his plans open to the nation before he thinks it is time. However, it seems that this is a real serious challenge and a trick to the Kremlin to figure out what office Putin can.
And again, this is the third time now in this hour, I might point out. Usually I wouldn't point that out, Dmitry Sidorov. Usually I would say we're just having technical difficulties. But given everything we've been hearing, I don't know, it's a paranoid in me. I can't help but wonder. Do you have a thought about that?
Well, I don't know. I don't have any problems here.
But, in Washington.
I would be surprised if I had any. But over there, well, who knows? Let me put it this way, Jackie. I think, first of all, quickly, I don't agree with Masha. I think that Putin is a dictator, and the dictatorship he implemented should be called a financial one, first of all. Now, I explained it early, and I will not waste time to do it again. Now, talking about this speculation on what might take place during the presidential elections in Russia, look, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Today's parliamentary elections didn't matter. Presidential elections in Russia don't matter because the matter of the fact is that the system in the bleak environment, as Russia was called by one of Seinfeld's characters, will not change. On one hand, there will be ongoing fight for the future and existing assets to divide between different groups and the Kremlin, and the destructive foreign policy posture, as well as internal nationalistic, highly nationalistic ideology, will continue. So, talking about the U.S.-Russian relations, I think that the U.S. should change its policy, its very damaging policy of trying to involve Russia into the world economic and political affairs, awaiting that the Kremlin's internal and foreign policy will soften as a result of it.
In fact, the rhetoric has been so harsh as well.
Well, the rhetoric, look, Mr. Kramer earlier said, we'll have to see. Now, the question is not what they have to see, but what they have to do. Because the Russian sales of weapons to Tehran and Damascus, support of disturbance in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf, and reluctance to accept tough sanctions against Iran in the UN, the UNSC, well, indicates to me that Russia is basically going different way from what the U.S. administration is trying to do and what this country is trying to do. I mean, the other issue is that the Kremlin is trying hard for quite a number of years to separate the U.S. from its Western allies. But this is a little bit different from what communists tried to do because they didn't have enough power. They were not that involved. But look, the deals with former Italian Prime Minister Berlusconi, the current one Prodi, the agreement between the French President Sarkozy during his meeting in Moscow with President Putin on the energy, on the share of the state energy producing companies in the capital of each other, and the day before yesterday, Russian PM Zubkov, Prime Minister Zubkov, during his trip to Canada, offered Prime Minister Harper to jointly explore the Arctic shelf. The Russian claimed its property a few months ago. I mean, everything is so clear. I guess even the it's clear for everyone, but for some reason, this administration is quite reluctant to do that.
Let's go back to Masha. She's managed to get through for a third time from Moscow. Thanks for being so persistent, Masha.
My pleasure.
I wanted to ask you, we're just listening to the economic consolidation Dmitry has outlined and how the West has been reacting to Russia and what the U.S. might or might not do. There are observers who say that while Putin is seeking to strengthen his hand here, that he's actually weakened it. Can you explain what that means?
If I may add a little bit to the U.S.-Russian relations,
mm-hmm.
I think harsher policy will not help the relations between Russia and the U.S., and actually certainly not the policy of an outgoing and a weak administration. It is true that Russia is trying to separate U.S. from its Western allies, but it's also true that there is no consensus between the U.S. and its Western allies about Russia, and of course Russia is using the differences that it sees, and I think this is good diplomacy, and any country would do that. I think what is needed first and foremost, not harsher policy, not softer policy. Russia is a very difficult partner. What is needed to improve the relations between Russia and the West is first and foremost consensus among the Western countries. And another thing, I think what is needed and what is lacking in the West is understanding Russia better. I see really a lot of unforward-looking policy moves. Also, I would like to mention that some of the rhetoric goes ahead of policies in Russia, and this is true internally and externally. There may be very harsh rhetoric, but not necessarily as harsh policies as well. This is especially true internally, and I want to point out again that Putin is not a dictator, and of all the paternalistic regimes that Russia has set throughout its history, this one is the least repressive, and also this one is when the proportion of people who enjoy reasonably decent lifestyles is higher than ever in the Russian history, and this is not to be ignored when we look at Russia. This is not just nickels and dimes. These are people who really admit in the polls that they live better, and this is quite something and would matter in any country, and as Clinton said in his time, it's the economy stupid. It explains a lot about Putin's popularity in his own country.
What about Europe's denunciation? Has that made any difference, some of the observations? And by the way, we've just got a couple minutes left here. You talked about the American reaction versus the European reaction and trying to separate them.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about the reaction to the Russian election?
Yes.
Or more general?
Yes, and also some of the concerns and sending observers from the
ICE. I don't think, frankly, the West has any leverage over Russia these days. I think Russia is reasserting itself frantically on the world scene. Russia is in an obstructionist mood. Russia may pursue its national interest, but also important about Russian foreign policy is a desire to make up for the humiliation over the time when Russia had to put up with being ignored. Its opinion being totally dismissed by the West, as in the time of bombing of Yugoslavia or the beginning of the war in Iraq. And now Russia enjoys the ability, and Putin revels in the ability to say no.
Dmitry, Jackie? A couple last words?
Yes. First of all, I should say that the West and the U.S. and the European Union has leverage. Again, I insist that Russia is a financial dictatorship. And here are two examples. Russia signed an anti-corruption agreement at the G8 summit in St. Petersburg in 2006, and there's Section 312 of the Patriot Act, which deals with, I quote, proceeds of foreign corruption, end of quote, and European Union money laundering directives on, I quote, political exposed persons, end of quote. And I think those are quite powerful tools. And to disregard those tools will be a big mistake. I agree with Masha that probably this outgoing administration will not try to implement those or even to think about those having them. But it does mean that the next administration will not turn to these tools.
All right. Well, we want to thank you both very much for being with us. Masha Lipman is a political analyst for the Carnegie Center in Moscow and editor-in-chief of the journal Pro et Contra, and she joined us today several times from Moscow. Dmitry Sidorov is the Washington bureau chief for the Russian newspaper Kommersant, and he joined us from our own capital in Washington. Again, we thank you both.
Thank you for having me here, Jackie.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see you again. I'm Jackie Leiden, and this is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and On Point, We're turning now at the end of our show to Caracas for the latest on yesterday's elections in Venezuela. President Hugo Chavez sought broad new powers, which Venezuelans voted down. Joining me now is Richard Lapper. He's the Latin America editor for the Financial Times. And are you with us, Richard?
I am indeed.
Ah, very good. So this was a surprise. Many observers had thought that Chavez would, in fact, succeed here. Tell us what happened. He certainly isn't quitting.
Yeah, I mean, the polls are indicating that the opposition were doing well, but I guess we all felt that Chavez's, famed capacity to mobilize his poor supporters would prevail in the end. And in fact, he fell short by a few hundred thousand votes in the end, So it was... It's very tight. In Chavez's own words last night, microscopic differences between the two sides. And it took an awful lot of to-ing and fro-ing, I think, and a certain amount of negotiation before the Central Electoral Council, the main electoral authority here, declared the votes at about 2 o'clock this morning. But the referendum has been defeated, and we are, to a large extent, I think, in a very real way, in new political territory now in Venezuela.
Well, how would you describe that territory? Because now, more than ever, the relative strength of the various points of view have been measured. But that's not going to mean stasis.
I think there are several elements. I mean, we've got to think back. In 2006, just over a year ago, Chavez won a landslide victory on pretty explicit proposals to socialize large chunks of this economy and to advance his 21st century socialist revolution. He's done exactly what he said he would do. He's nationalized telecommunications and the electricity companies, extended state control over the oil industry, and he's closed down one very critical but rather popular right-wing TV station, or rather taken it off the terrestrial airwaves. He's been very radical, and this constitutional proposal would have allowed him to be more radical still had he won it. He was talking about the possibility of being elected repeatedly, which would have allowed him essentially to stay in power.
The Cuba model.
For life. Mm-hmm. Tremendous concentration of power. Now, that's been rejected. One of the reasons it's been rejected is that there have been a certain amount of dissension within Chavez's own ranks. And there's been an emergence, I think, very largely triggered by the protests against the closure of the taking off the TV station off the air in May, of a new protest movement among students, and that's given a new tinge to the opposition. It's a different sort of opposition to that which for previous elections have. It's a more constructive opposition, possibly a more moderate opposition.
It sounds as if Chavez has not been able to dominate the opposition, say, the way we just had been hearing in this hour of our radio program about Vladimir Putin and Russia. There isn't anything like quite the same domination of the opposition and control of all the media outlets.
Well, I think we're still at a stage where the opposition is quite fragmented. Many of the old parties that rule this country through the 40 years from 1958 to 1998, when Chavez was first elected, are still largely discredited. The new parties have not really taken their places yet, but there are new political actors on the stage now. And I think, we are... I think the other thing to stress in all this is that a lot of attention is paid to the way in which high oil prices and have allowed Chavez to spend an awful lot of money in poor areas on things like education and health and cheap food and so on. People are less conscious, perhaps, of some of the economic distortions that government policy is largely responsible for. We've got tremendous problems in terms of food shortages. There's rising inflation here. And this is particularly damaging in poor areas. And I think the other interesting thing about this this particular poll is there was a lot of disaffection and disenchantment amongst Chavez's own supporters. And he himself said late last night that he'd lost because of the high level of abstention in his own support base.
Is this going to actually weaken his hold on power in any way? I mean, he seemed to intimate in his comments this may be put aside for now, but then he then echoed those words in Spanish, just for now. Any predictions about the next move or speculations?
Yeah, I mean, Chavez is determined to try to convert this setback into a moral victory, which he's done before. In 1992, when he launched an unsuccessful military coup and said it had failed for now, he committed himself last night to continue the push for 21st century socialism. He's got considerable power still. He has a certain number of decree powers that the Assembly gave him earlier this year, and I think he'll be looking to. I don't think there's any sign at this stage that he's going to desist from a radical course of action. You know, it's not clear. The Chavistas or his supporters would argue that, you know, that there may have been a certain lack of enthusiasm about these particular constitutional proposals, but many of the people who didn't vote yesterday are still essentially Chavez supporters.
All right, and that's where we'll have to leave it, because I'm sure there will be more story to tell later. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Richard Lapper is Latin American editor for the Financial Times, and he spoke with us from Caracas. And you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website on onpointradio.org. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.